Welcome to Eucharist Podcast, where we're exploring what it looks like for a community of disciples to live all of life in reference to Christ. All right, welcome back to our discussion of Chapter 5 of the Patient Ferment of the Early Church. This chapter is called Communities as Cultures of Patience. So in this chapter, we talk about, you know, the continuing theme of the patient ferment of the early church, how they were patient. But now it gets into this aspect of how that patience permeated all of their life and all the various aspects of life and living in the culture they found themselves in. But one of the first questions is, where did they learn their distinctive way of life? Where did they learn patience? Where did they learn their habitus from? Because obviously it wasn't from the culture. So Ryan, where did the early church learn to do the things that they did? How were they formed?
Well, according to Alan Kreider in this book here, it's they learned it from the church itself. And that was a tricky thing because the church existed in the midst of another culture. So there's a great quote that he has early on in this chapter, and it's kind of an extended quote, and I want to read it to you because it's so instructive about this tension here. It's from the second century epistle of Diognetus, and we actually don't know who wrote it. Here's the quote. He says, "For Christians are no different from other people in terms of their country, language, or customs. Nowhere do they inhabit cities of their own, use a strange dialect, or live out of the ordinary. They inhabit both Greek and barbarian cities according to the lot assigned to each, and they show forth the character of their own citizenship in a marvelous and admittedly paradoxical way by following local customs in what they wear and what they eat and in the rest of their lives. They live in their respective countries, but only as resident aliens. They participate in all things as citizens, and they endure all things as foreigners. They marry like everyone else and have children, but they do not expose them once they are born. They share their meals, but not their sexual partners. They are obedient to the laws that have been made, and by their own lives, they supersede the laws. They are impoverished and make many rich. To put the matter simply, what the soul is in the body, this is what Christians are in the world." So such a great quote. And he's trying to highlight a tension between two different impulses and what Dr. Kreider summarizes as two different principles using sociological language. And he has the one principle is the indigenizing principle, and the other one is what he calls the pilgrim principle. So Joshua, can you give us a little insight into what he means by that?
So his idea of the indigenizing principle and the pilgrim principle really goes back to the quote that we just heard, especially the line resident aliens, because here in the indigenizing principle, we talk about how people are resident in culture.
Like, how do they belong?
How do they belong
in the city that they live in or the place that they live in?
Yeah, and often, you know, what are some of those good aspects of the city and the culture that they live in that we can honor and that they can actually bring into their Christian life, into the Christian community? Mm-hmm. But then there's also this tension. There's the pilgrim principle. What parts of their culture are alien to the kingdom of God and must be left at the door?
Mm.
And so this is something that I've been wrestling and exploring for more than a decade, especially with our work overseas,
mm-hmm.
because this has to happen in mission. In mission, mm-hmm. you have to be able to embody and explore what it means to be resident aliens.
Mm-hmm.
What's that quote that you recently talked about? You mentioned it's a...
Are you talking about from Leslie Newbegin?
Leslie Newbegin, yeah.
Yeah, so Leslie Newbegin was a missionary in India, and he came from a British context, and he recognized as he had his missionary encounters that the gospel is never naked of culture. It never comes without clothes on. It always comes clothed in culture, which is the indigenizing aspect of it. But then when the gospel encounters a culture, it also, as you said, says no to certain things, like certain parts can't come in. And so the gospel is always creating a third culture. It's not the culture it came from. It's not the culture that it comes to. It's something different than both of those. And that's always the tension So like Dr. Kreider in this book refers to Christians as hybrid people. Mm-hmm. Like they're not foreigners in a sense in the place where they live, but they also have aspects of them that are alien. And so they can't quite ever just be settled in as just residents. They're always resident aliens in some way.
And this is a messy and complicated process. This is not just something you give people a list of do's and don'ts and automatically they're enculturated into the kingdom.
Right.
Like it takes a lot of prayer and exploration and a community really to discern as a group what can we do and what can't we do? What can we honor and participate in and what must we abstain and detest?
And sometimes it's actually the people who are not from the culture that is being contacted by the gospel that can see most clearly what is and isn't of the gospel. Like for instance, it's really interesting how it's the Africans and the Latin American Christians and the Asian Christians that are often able to see how Western Christianity has basically gotten into bed with capitalism or has gotten into bed with a kind of liberal autonomy of the self. They can see that in ways that we cannot, which is actually why the missionary encounter is a really important part of the gospel, because everywhere you go around the world, we're seeing, me as a Westerner going to places, you know, like I was in Uganda a year and a half ago. When I go to Uganda, I see things that they don't see. Mm-hmm. When you were in China and in Thailand, you saw things they did not see. But similarly, they see things about us that we cannot see. And so none of us have like a grasp on the naked gospel. We're always discerning that in a conversation between cultures in some way.
I think this is beautiful, and this is why we really need to embrace and redeem the term Catholic.
Yeah.
Because Catholic
What does Catholic mean?
Means of the whole and universal. And so when the church stops seeing itself merely as individual churches and starts looking at the church globally and also throughout history, that we actually have more voices in the conversation that join us as we try to discern what is good, true, and right. And so this is part of the whole why we're doing this book is because we're saying, okay, early church.
Cause,
help us.
Because through time, there's differences too. Like I think one of my favorite C.S. Lewis references where he says, the reason you read old books is because they make mistakes, but not the same ones that we're making. You know, like the authors have different insights. So so that's part of what's going on in this chapter here is he's really getting into that sort of complexity there.
I think here, this is a great question for us now is then, okay, Ryan, here we are in San Francisco. In 2016, what can we praise and what do we need to not?
What do we need to resist?
Yeah, because I think it's really easy to go to the extremes on either way. We have either, in missions we call it going native, where you basically uncritically accept everything and you enter too fully into a culture and it actually negates or... you're stripped of your Christian distinction.
Yeah.
And so if you go native in a culture, you embrace everything, you don't see anything critical, and you basically become indistinguishable from the host culture.
Yeah.
But then there's also the tension in the other direction to resist everything,
right.
To basically say everything is wrong about this culture and to be colonial.
Yeah.
And basically say, no, you must... do things this certain way.
Yeah.
And if not, we're going to go and set up our own little kingdom somewhere else.
Yeah. So one of the ways I've talked about this is there's a tension that I feel sometimes with Christians in the city. They come here, they have a career path they're on, they're involved in school, or they're really excited about something about San Francisco. And sometimes the sense that they communicate is, I just really want a chaplain. I think life is pretty much as it should be. Like I can, you know, they're flowing with the culture just fine. And so then the church is put in this role of really just being a chaplain of the already existing culture. And that would only be possible if the culture was really already distinctively Christian. But the problem is that it's not. And so this is one of the problems of the American church is it has basically taken on a chaplaincy mode in the American context. And so it doesn't see the places where there needs to be resistance. Now, the opposite of that would be, to use a metaphor, would be a bunker mindset, where you just get down in the bomb shelter and you stay down there and you wait for everything to pass. That is not a Christian way to relate either to culture. So chaplaincy is probably not a good metaphor for what we're doing here in San Francisco, and neither is the bomb shelter. So the metaphor we try to use is the metaphor, I think we've already talked about it here, is the metaphor of an embassy. Yeah. And I think that ambassadors, people who are working in embassies, they have to be, they're hybrid people, as the author in this says about this chapter here, that they know how to live in both cultures. They understand. They have something distinctive to offer, though. And once they let go of that, they've let go of their whole purpose. Mm-hmm. So again, I think the embassy is a really good good metaphor for us.
You know, I think so too. And this whole kind of bunker mentality, I think, is almost a play on words with the Christian subculture in America right now, that we've kind of dug ourselves our own little niche below culture and never want to kind of go up and interact with it. Because I think,
or they just mimic culture in their own sort of isolated sphere, right? Like, you know, whatever the hot band is in the top 40, then there's like a Christian alternative.
We're going
to
make our separate.
Yeah. Which is really just a mimicking of culture rather than like something creative or different, right?
Yeah. So San Francisco, how can we embody and practice the indigenizing principle here? What are things that are true, good, and beautiful in our city with our people that we can say yes to?
Well certainly our city is known as a place of immense creativity, and creativity being a reflection of our creator, that we are made in the image of God. So the emphasis on arts, the emphasis on innovation, the emphasis on beauty and order and design, these are good things that we can celebrate. Now, every single one of those can be taken to an end in itself and become an idol. But as qualities that describe the city, they're wonderful things that we can celebrate. And I think we ought to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been very surprised with some, it's kind of hard to say it this way, but some of the selflessness I see in the tech world. Hmm. Now, underneath all of it, people want to make a name for themselves. They want to have success. But there's a sense of people are willing to work incredibly hard and be part of a team, knowing that when they work as a team, they can do things that they can't accomplish as an individual. Mm-hmm. So there is this like really beautiful self-giving to a company or to a brand that actually is quite nice. It's just like, man, you're giving it to the wrong thing.
Yeah, yeah. There is a kind of quasi-collectivism that happens, but it happens in careers. Mm-hmm. Maybe another example would be this city has historically been a place that has emphasized quite a bit giving a voice to the marginalized, which I think is something that, as you said earlier to me, Joshua, resonates with the prophets in the mm-hmm. Old Testament, and the emphasis on the orphan, the widow, the elderly, in the scriptures. And here in San Francisco, there's been an emphasis on trying to give voice to those who the American society doesn't want to hear, whether that goes back to the civil rights movement and the actions on San Francisco State campus many years ago, or on Berkeley and the free speech movement, things like that. There's been a lot of good that's come out of that. Now, we can quickly move to the Pilgrim principle and say, well, there are also some ways on all these things we're talking about where we go, no, we can't actually go with you all the way there. And so there's some places where we have to resist.
If I would say it's great, this value to listen to those on the margin. Mm-hmm. The part that's not so great is there's not a clear line where the boundary is. Mm-hmm. So margin implies you're off somewhere in the corner, of an existing plane. But there's been a blurring of boundaries, and so there's kind of a lifting up of just minority voices. Some of those need to be heard. Some of them aren't actually helpful or constructive, and historically or within the Christian worldview would actually be outside the plane of where we should operate. So they're not on the margins. They're actually outside the gates.
Well, maybe another way to say it too would be to say that the emphasis on inclusion in San Francisco is interesting, because you have to ask inclusion in what? What is the thing that the people are being included in, and it's very hollow. That's the problem with it. There's actually nothing there to be included in many cases, because what's really been emphasized is individual autonomy. And individual autonomy means that it's me, myself, and I. there's not a we, really, you know? And so I think San Francisco struggles with a kind of loneliness and alienation from itself in many cases, because it wants to give voice to the margins to include people in something, but there's nothing to be included in many cases. And so I think that's where, as Christians, we come along and we have a very different kind of inclusion. It's an inclusion in Christ, which comes on his terms and is headed towards a particular end. And there is a thing to be included in. There is a mm-hmm. body of Christ to be included in, a body politic, a social experience of some kind. And that is so deeply needed in a place like San Francisco. So I think conversations around inclusion could be really confusing sometimes, because, you know, there is much good to be said for values of listening to the marginalized and the poor and including, et cetera. And, but I think we have to be careful how we actually work that principle out within the life of the church.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Well, let's look at a few in the chapter. He begins to give some definition to some of the what distinguished the church and what ways were they distinguished. And I'll just run through a few of these here, and then we can summarize and talk about a few of the other things that are important. So he says that something that made them distinctive was that they were patient in business. They refused to do lawsuits, especially against each other. Christians would not sue each other, and they really, in general, stayed out of the law courts. They were very plain in their dealings with other people, sometimes honest to the point of losing out on business. And so if you were going to be dominant in business, being a Christian was sometimes hard on that. And maybe this is part of the patience thing, like your business just doesn't flourish in some cases.
That's actually really interesting, because when I was doing doctoral studies in Malaysia, one of my colleagues did his doctoral dissertation on business as missions, specifically in China. Mm-hmm. And he's of Chinese heritage. And his conclusion was it was impossible as a foreigner or a non-local Chinese person to come in as an outsider and to succeed in business in China as a Christian. Mm-hmm. Because you could not have a business that was successful enough to necessitate, or you can have a business that was successful enough to provide you a visa. Hmm. Because to be a successful business that could give visas to yourself, your family, and others, you would have to be corrupt. You would have to be paying someone on the side. And even if you were able to somehow be successful as a Christian in doing business in China, people would assume that you were and scrupulous, that you were deceptive, that you could not be trusted. You would be respected because you have money and prestige, but you would not be trusted. I thought that was very interesting. And a lot of people did not like his conclusion, but it kind of gets to this, that actually sometimes being a Christian means losing at business.
Mm-hmm. Another distinctive characteristic he said was Christians were known for their sexual discipline. In other words, that they stayed married, or when there was a divorce, they chose not to remarry if a disaster happened of some kind. They focused sexuality on the appropriateness of sexuality only belonged within the marriage vow between a man and a woman. And so this distinguished them. And actually, interestingly, in the ancient world, in some cases, their sexual discipline earned them honor. I don't think that's really the case at this point. I think, like, obviously marriage and sexuality is a major point of tension between what's happening in the movement of culture in a place like San Francisco and what's happening in church. So this is maybe a point of tension at this point. But at some points in the past, it was actually something celebrated by the pagan world, where they thought, wow, look at you Christians. You actually have discipline, and they honored that. He talks about men, women, and children being together, and that was a distinctive thing that in the ancient world, really, they were just separate. All those groups were separate from each other. One of these sections was interesting to me, and this is the fourth characteristic. He talked about divine power, about how exorcism was super important to the growth of the church. In fact, it was so important that one of the people that he quoted in here, a historian, a guy named Ramsey McMullen, says that the exorcism was the chief instrument of conversion in the in the early church, which I thought was fascinating because obviously that's not the way it works in our setting right now. But it does seem like wherever the gospel goes, there's this, the burning edge of the gospel always brings with it signs and wonders. And that shouldn't be surprising to us. And maybe there's going to be a return to more of that happening in post-Christian settings like San Francisco. It certainly does already happen. Along with that, he talked about healing and the importance of that too. He talked about how for the early church, Christianity worked. And that's why people believed in its powers, because it actually did something, which I think was fascinating as well. Mm. A fifth characteristic he talked about was care for the poor. The Christian community was, as he described it, modestly redistributive. Like they would take their wealth and they would pass it around the community, and it was just expected. The sixth characteristic he talks about was a prohibition on taking life. The early church was fairly unanimous on the fact that abortion was completely inappropriate for Christians. When people would do what's called exposing their babies, if it was born, there was something wrong with it, or they didn't like the gender, they would just leave their baby on the street. Christians said, no way, we do not do that. In fact, they would take those children and bring them and raise them up in their own households. They also didn't believe in military action in the early first few centuries of the church, and things like death sentence. They were very much opposed to the games in the arena, which were a form of entertainment, but also a form of capital punishment. And so early Christians were opposed to all these things, and that made them distinguished in some ways. And then the last characteristic that he talks about was that they did not believe in compulsion as a way of doing God's work. Like they didn't believe they had to force people into conversion. There was a kind of freedom that they assumed was important to God. And they could do that in some ways because they believed in the final judgment, which is that God is the only one who has the right to compel. And so because God was going to do that at some point in the future, they could relax and let God do his work in his time.
Nice. So how Ryan, how do you see us as a community at Eucharist living into these things? How do you see us embodying this habitus and being embassies of the gospel here in San Francisco?
Well, I think all those items we just mentioned will probably be really good areas for us to continue to dial in on and work on. And you know, part of what we're doing with this podcast is we're trying to capture a sense of imagination for how this could look and how it would feel. And I think we actually struggle with a poverty of imagination. Mm-hmm. We just assume that church is like it was where we grew up, or if we didn't grow up in the church, we don't even have an imagination of what it might be, you know? And so I think, again, reading a book like this gives us a window, albeit a historical window, into how did a church live as a resident alien in another culture now, or clearly in that setting right now.
Yeah.
So, I think we can lean into a lot of these areas here.
Yeah. For me, if you look at page 122, he talks about some of the components of habitus, and he has a list of them. Two of the ones that really resonated with me a lot was when he mentioned Christians' value of meeting frequently, and then later on, being willing to lose out in business. Now, maybe for most that might not seem connected, but in my time in the Bay Area and San Francisco, I see that being connected because careers here have such a drain on people's time and like a demand on their time that it's really hard for us as a Christian community to be together enough to cultivate a habitus.
Yeah,
because you know, if you're not putting in 70 hours or 80 hours a week at your job, somebody is. Yeah. And if you want to advance, you know, you get into this competition and this kind of trying, basically your work becomes your community because it's having, it becomes, you know, sometimes your spouse, your best friend.
Right.
And I don't think that's right. I think there's a sense where we as Christians need to remember the Sabbath and the whole idea behind, or part of the whole idea behind the Sabbath is telling time differently. And this revolutionary act of rest and patience, saying, you know what, I'm not going to till my field or water my field one day of the week, because if I do, I'm going to get into this habit and this habitus of thinking that I'm the one that causes the growth.
Yeah.
I'm going to take one day a week to recenter, to reimagine, and to remember that it's God that causes the growth. And it's this great act of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And it builds you. I think it helps confront this habitus and this gravity that teaches us that we're just consumers or producers. I think here in San Francisco, a lot of people's value is what they can bring to the company,
yeah,
their productivity, and to be able to say, no, I'm not going to work past this time, or to have, yeah, boundaries of some sort is a revolutionary act of faith, saying, you know, God's still going to take care of me if I honor his law and remember him as God, because he's the one that's going to give me honor and provide me my daily bread.
Yeah, I think what's difficult about that is that a lot of people came to the Bay Area for a job.
Yeah.
That's why they're here. And so then for them to hear, you know, two guys like us on a podcast, you know, sitting here talking about how they should work less, it's like, well, convenient, you know, like, this is your job, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think, yeah, there's definitely something that bridges on idolatry in the culture around work in the, yeah, Bay Area. And it goes with this, it's fueled by this notion here in Silicon Valley and San Francisco that whatever people are doing at their work is changing the world. And so that's where the action is. If you want to be about changing the world, then work 80 or 100 hours a week, because that next app or that next thing or that next healthcare breakthrough, that, you know, whatever it is, that's going to be where the action actually happens. And so I think, again, Christians, if they're going to be really Christians, they have to reimagine, where is the action actually happening? Where is the locus of God's power? Where is the center of joy and of peace and of righteousness? Let's be honest, it's actually not in your job. And that's a hard message for a lot of San Franciscans to hear, because there are valuable things about your job and that you're doing. There's important work that people are doing. But if it becomes an end that takes us away from Christ and his kingdom and the community of Christ that we're hopefully being formed into, then it's hard to say that it really is a good thing at the end of the day on that. So I think there's tension there. And I know I don't probably sort suss it out exactly the way that other people might, but I don't want to relieve us of that tension. We, yeah, got to think about that.
And I think it's interesting because, to be honest, most of my life I viewed Sunday as the end of the week. And so you're giving God what's left over instead of realizing that the Sabbath is actually the beginning of the week. Or Sunday is this the beginning of the week. You're actually giving God your first fruits. And, mm-hmm, what does that look like, practicing Sabbath, not only of rest, but actually giving God your best and not just what's left over after 12 hours at your job?
Yeah. Yeah. I think practicing a Sabbath is definitely, it's a countercultural thing here. And also a true Sabbath. We haven't gotten into this, and maybe we will another time, but a day off is maybe not the exact same thing as a Sabbath. And so, yeah, anyway, that would be something to take up another time. So a couple other things that struck me here. These are really simple things, but part of the Christian habitus is praising and thanking God. This is the way that we talk about at our church all the time, doing all of life in reference to Christ. And thanksgiving is such an important part of that. When we offer thanks, we take the goods and the things that we love in our life and we put them in relationship to God, that God is the giver of all those gifts. So that's a really important part of our habitus, is to constantly give thanks. And then this other one here, making the sign of the cross. This has been fun for me over the last few years. I've begun doing this more and more. Whenever I hear the Trinitarian name, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, I cross myself. And it just reminds me bodily whose I am, that I belong to the Trinity, that my life is not my own. And so I think that sometimes these bodily actions, these bodily movements, can be really powerful.
Mm. Wonderful, man. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening in on our conversation of the patient ferment of the early church. Stay tuned for next week as we discuss chapter 6.